Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host. So today, we have Annie Duke on the show. How are you doing today, Annie?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Good. Well, glad to have you on the show. I'm kind of a fanboy for your books. I think they're just really phenomenal at getting to the heart of these mental model concepts that I think are really hard for people to grasp. And you do it with such eloquent stories. So maybe you could tell the listeners a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are now.
I started off my adult life as an academic. I was studying cognitive science at the University of Pennsylvania. I did 5 years worth of graduate work there with the intention of becoming a professor. But life had other plans for me. I got sick in the last year of graduate school and actually ended up in the hospital for a couple of weeks. And it happened to be right when I was supposed to go out for my job talk. So it became clear that I needed to take some time off in order to heal up. So took a leave of absence, you know, was planning to go back after a year to sort of button everything up and go back out on the job market. But it was during that year that I frankly just kind of needed money because I didn't have my fellowship. I was taking a leave from school. And so I didn't have an income source. And I started playing poker during that year and thought, well, this is fine. I'll do this in the meantime in order to support myself. And ended up finding success pretty quickly and kept going and did it for 18 years. Just so people know how kind of weird that was at the time. This was in the 90s before poker was on television or on the internet. And so at that time, people really kind of thought about it as, you know, what I would generally go under as a sin or an addiction or that category. So most of my conversations when people heard I played poker ended up somewhere in the Gamblers Anonymous. So, have you thought about Gamblers Anonymous? And I would try to explain it's like investing, but, you know, it was just a very strange thing to do. The reason why I got introduced to it was because my brother had already been playing for 10 years and, you know, supporting himself with that endeavor. So anyway, I started playing poker. I did pretty well at it. I won a world championship and the tournament champions and the NBC National Heads Up Championship. At some point, I was the winningest woman in the history of the game. Not anymore. But then again, I did retire in 2012. So there's been 10 years for people to beat. In 2002, which was about 8 years into when I was really playing poker exclusively at that point, I got asked to come speak to a group of options traders about how poker might inform their thinking about risk. I gave a talk about how your risk attitudes get distorted by whether you're winning or losing in a game, which is more kind of a merging of the sort of behavioral science, behavioral economics with sort of what you see at a poker table. And when I gave that talk, I kind of remembered a few things. One is I really love teaching. And so I really got energized by that and wanted to get back to it. And the other is that I also love academics. You know, I had left for a variety of reasons and found something else that I was really good at, you know, but that sort of diving into those types of conversations was really fun for me. So started developing a speaking career where I was speaking on this sort of intersection between cognitive psychology and poker. Eventually started getting asked to do some consulting, was sort of trying my hand at that to see what I would think about that. And in 2012, I retired from poker in order to focus on that full time, as well as wanting to found this nonprofit, the Alliance for Decision Education, where we're trying to bring decision education into every K-12 classroom. I did that in 2014. And then really wanted to write this book, Thinking in Bets, which was essentially a book that was sort of a compilation of the talks that I'd been given that I really wanted to be able to get out to the world in broader form. And I did that, and that got published in 2018. And then I followed it with How to Decide and Now Quit, which just came out in October of 2022. So just started really thinking about like writing in that space, which I think was this way for me to get back to academics in a way that like I really loved and I really enjoyed. And now I've come full circle because I teach executive ed at Wharton. So I'm back at the University of Pennsylvania. I do research with Phil Tetlock and Barb Mellers in psychology and also Marie Schweitzer, who's over at Wharton, on a variety of different sort of things under, you know, judgment and decision-making. The work that I do specifically with Phil Tetlock is in forecasting. And I've recently enrolled as a graduate student there to finish my PhD.
You obviously have a wide range of things that you've done. And I want to touch on one of them you mentioned, which you remember playing poker. And what I wanted to ask is, at a high level, like, how does poker relate to investing? To me, in your books, it seems you illustrate it very well as to, you know, why it's important, but maybe you can share that with the audience.
Let me just start with this. Poker is investing, it's trading. So you're dealt a hand and you have some model of the world. In this case, you have a model of your opponents at the table and you understand statistically what the probability is that that hand is going to win on its own merits or not, given the number of people that are in the hand or the number of people that are at the table. And then you're figuring out things about what's the probability I could bluff and still win, so on and so forth. So what you're really doing is a forecast at that time. It's very similar to a thesis. I have this hand. I know certain things about this hand. I have a model of my opponents. And the question is, if I invest a dollar here, do I feel like I'm getting a positive return? And I'm thinking about what my expectations are for what I might see in the future, which would be akin to like fundamentals. You know, there's also, interestingly enough, there's things that have to do with the macro environment that you're in, which would be broadly as like a loose game or a tight game, which is a similar way to think about those things. Yeah. So then you're making a forecast of whether you think the hand is worth playing. You're making predictions about how your opponents are going to behave. You're tracking the new cards that get turned face up, which is the influence of luck on the outcome. And then very much just like investing, you either win or lose the hand, but on that one iteration, it's not particularly informative. So you have some of the same challenges in terms of closing feedback loops that you have in investing, which is that over the long run, your outcomes are going to tell you a lot about the quality of your decisions, but in the short run, it's not. All right, I lost a hand, but why? Did I lose it because I played poorly? Did I lose it because all those judgments that I made were wrong? Did I overestimate the chances I could bluff? Did I have a poor model of my opponent? Those kinds of things that would be like a judgment issue. Or was it just that I got bad luck? Because there's volatility. And I think that that creates this very unique problem in poker that applies to investing as well, where you're making decisions to put positions on under conditions of uncertainty, where you know very little in comparison to all there is to be known. And the outcome in the investment is going to be heavily influenced by luck. And if you win or lose on a particular position, what does that mean? I don't know. So I think that how you think about poker and how you approach that problem, what are the weaknesses in human judgment that that particular environment exposes? What are the ways that you might address those weaknesses in human judgment, so on and so forth? I think those actually pretty much directly map onto investing. The difference in investing is that you have more time and you don't necessarily have to make your decisions alone, which makes it a little bit easier of a problem, but nonetheless, still incredibly difficult.
Well, you mentioned a few points I wanted to pull out there. One was resulting, which is determining whether your success or failure was due to luck or skill or something else. Can you kind of expand on that topic? Because I think that's something that is hard for people to grasp because you see the winners and you just say, oh, that was really a smart decision.
Right. So resulting in particular is something called outcome bias. So I call it resulting. The academic term is outcome bias. And it's that we will take the outcome and directly map it onto the quality of the decision. So if we're seeing another investor, we're looking at a fund, and we see the fund had a good year, we'll think it's a good fund. And if we think the fund had a bad year, we'll think it's a bad fund. And you can see that very directly, actually, in the decisions of allocators in terms of who they're allocating their money to. And we know that this is an error that occurs where the managers who have a really good year, the allocators will stick to and often give more money to. And the managers who have kind of a bad year, they'll ditch. And then we know what happens, right? Like that ends up regressing back to the mean, mainly because like it's just kind of not enough data. And that's where you start to get into this resulting problem, right? Which is just because someone did well doesn't mean that they're super smart. So I'll give you a very simple example of this particular concept. I think that anybody who was managing an individual's money between, say, fall of 2021 and May of 2022. I'm guessing that whoever's portfolio they're managing did amazing. But does that make them a good money manager? because we can see it's like, well, it depends, right? It depends. How did everybody else do? Like, we kind of need to know what beta is. Like, we need to know a whole bunch of other stuff. How did they make their decisions? Were they asking their uncle what to invest in? Like, what were their theses? Like, we don't know any of that. Just because someone did really well, it doesn't mean that they were making good decisions, but we think it does. And likewise, when someone is doing poorly, we think it's because they made bad decisions. And that is also not necessarily true. So this is generally the resulting problem. And it causes us to learn very bad lessons from the experience that's available to us. Because the experience that's available to us is like people do well or they do poorly. And then how do we judge that? So that's kind of what happens when we're like looking at other people. What's interesting though, is when we look at ourselves, we actually engage in something called self-serving bias. And I'm sure that you've heard this before. When someone wins in a position, they made great decisions. When someone lost, like, what could I do? The pandemic hit, or the macro environment went south, or, you know, I got unlucky. There were things that I couldn't possibly have foreseen, like all these ways to sort of offload it off of yourself. So we kind of have a twofold problem, right? As we're sort of examining the things that are occurring in the world, we're doing this kind of one-to-one correspondence between outcome quality and decision quality. That's really bad. But when we're thinking about ourselves, and this is something you see in poker a lot, we'll tend to attribute the good stuff to our own skill and the bad stuff to luck. And neither of those patterns is correct. All of it can occur. I can make a bad decision, get a bad outcome. I can make a bad decision, get a good outcome. I can make a good decision, get a good outcome. I can make a good decision and get a bad outcome. And in the short run, certainly the outcome itself doesn't really tell us very much.
We see that a lot with the financial advisory world, where if the market goes up, hey, I was a genius, and the market went down and, oh, that was the market. There's nothing we could do. You just got to hold on.
There's nothing we could have done. I actually just had a discussion with someone the other day where I was trying to get some money moved from place A to place B, or telling them that they needed to move their money from place A to place B. And they said to me, this was just for purposes of getting it to the person who was managing the funds as opposed to a different place. The person that I was having a discussion with said, well, I don't want to move it from there because that money's been doing really well there. And I was like, so is everybody else's. I think this conversation was in the summer before everything started to crash, or the spring, whatever. I was like, but it's that real desire to attribute the good performance to something particular about that person. And what I said is, they may or may not be good. That's actually not why I want you to move the money. But the fact that they've done well over the past few months is meaningless. Every human being who just parked their money in the S&P has made a gazillion dollars. But then the flip side is, every person who's had their money parked in the S&P recently has lost a gazillion dollars. Does that mean it was a bad decision? No, not necessarily. It depends on what your goals are and what your values are. And we need to understand all of those things before we can figure out. Just in the same sense, it would be silly if I lost a hand of poker to you for you to assume you're a better player than me. Who knows? Maybe you are, but we'd have to play a lot more.
Or I could just take my win and just hang it over you forever.
That's true. You could do that. That's fair. That's totally a fair strategy.
That's a good segue into your new book about quitting. So I haven't fully read the book, but I flipped through the concepts, and I think a lot of them were really interesting in the fact that a lot of us look at winners and, you know, they just say, oh, they're really resilient and they gutted it out and they kept at it, and that's why they won. Why did you decide to write this book, Quit? What was kind of the reasoning behind it?
Because I was very frustrated about somewhat what you just said. I was frustrated about this kind of lore that we have around grit, that grit is some magical quality that causes success, in the sense of, look, it's totally true that somebody who has succeeded stuck to it. I do not deny that. But that does not mean if you stick to it, you'll succeed. Those two things do not mean the same thing. They aren't equally true. One is true and the other is not. Because one is, you know the outcome, so you kind of know the person stuck to it. And the other is, does that mean you should stick to it? That's the question that we need to ask ourselves. And the answer is, well, that's absurd. You need to have grit as a quality to get you to stick to things that are worthwhile, even when they're hard. But grit for grit's sake gets you to stick to things that aren't worthwhile just because you think that, like, winners never quit. And I think that we can all remember like the early American Idol where they would show the bad singers auditioning. And, you know, Simon Cowell would say, like, this is not for you. You're not going to become a professional singer. And they would go out of the room and say to the camera, like, he's wrong. I know. If I just stick to it, I'll succeed. And we're all looking at it, what? No, that's not true. But what we hear is like the stories of the artist who went to 20 different labels and finally got their album deal, and then they succeeded. And then we hear these sort of survivor stories, and we forget about the thousands of people trying to do the same thing where time is just wasting away. So I just felt like someone needed to have a conversation with Grit, not with Angela Duckworth, because Angela Duckworth, in large part, I think agrees with me about this, that it's not so much stick to it and you'll succeed. It's try a bunch of stuff. If something is working for you, if it's worthwhile, if it's something you're really passionate about, stick to that, but then literally quit everything else. And I think that we really forget about the quit everything else part, because if you're going to be successful, it's incredibly important actually not to stick to things that aren't working. Because every minute that you stick to something that's not working is time and effort and attention and money that you could be turning towards something that would be working. So that is actually the road to success. In the simplest sense, like, what if you only held every single stock that you ever bought? That was your strategy. I buy a stock, I hold it forever because grit is amazing. And if I stick to it, then I'll succeed. You know, you're smiling because you can see that that's completely absurd, except that literally that's the advice that we give people. Just stick to it. Don't quit. If you quit, it's a lack of character. And I just thought someone should say that out loud.
Well, Wall Street loves that because they want you to buy and they never want you to sell. So they would love it if you had a portfolio full of stocks like that.
What Wall Street wants, right, is, well, not what Wall Street wants. What an investor wants, who is not an active investor, is to index the S&P 500. But here's the thing. The S&P 500 itself changes. If you look at the companies that were in that index 50 years ago, they're different than the companies that were there today. So anytime that you quit something that, you know, that you stop something that you started, that's quitting. So when a company gets taken out of that index and a new company gets put in it, that's a form of quitting. I'm quitting this and putting this in. So, you know, and that's true, obviously, like if you buy an ETF, if you, whatever, like there's lots of quitting happening in there. So we can separate out this strategy of like long hold, which fine, and understand that like what you're holding still changes.
You know, there's a concept a few people have talked about, which is a survivorship bias, like what you're saying, which is, you know, we look at history and all we see are the survivors. We don't see the quitters. So we don't have a lot of information to go back and look through that and say, how is this a successful decision? So how have you been able to kind of look at that and make that judgment? Because it's hard if you can't find the data, and to analyze, it's even harder.
Well, I mean, obviously, one thing you can look at is base rates. Here's a simple base rate. Like of the people who raise a seed round, how many of those successfully raise a Series A? You can say of the people who raise a seed round, how many of those successfully raise a Series C? So then we can start to get a sense of how many people are kind of like getting shoved aside along the way, right? And we can start to see sort of the negative space then, the people that you don't hear about. I read something on Twitter of somebody saying it took me 14 months to raise my first round. So what I tell you is don't ever give up. So it's a very classic example of survivorship bias, right? Like I stuck to it for 14 months and then it worked out for me. So therefore, that is what you should do because apparently sticking it for 14 months works. But what I would want to know as a decision maker is what's the average time to actually raise your round? What are the things that you need to do in order to kind of hit that mark, right? So like, do you have someone who's coaching you on the deck, for example, whatever, you figure out what those inputs are. And then if I'm well beyond the average time, I should take that as signal that there is an appetite in the market for it. And just because one person did it doesn't mean it's correct to do. Let me try to give you a sense that might be clearer. There are people who have been on top of Mount Everest and there's been a huge blizzard that's rolled in. And they have still summited and they've lived. But does that make it a good decision? If you're in the middle of a snowstorm on the top of Mount Everest, should you keep going to the summit just because somebody happened to somehow survive that situation? I think you can see there very clearly the answer is no, of course you shouldn't. The probability of death is too high. So if we take somebody like a founder who's pitching, and let's say the average time to raise a Series A is 9 months, whether a seed series. So let's say that the average time to raise your first round is 9 months. I'm making that up, by the way. I'm just making that number up. But let's say that that were the case. You could say, okay, so what's the most above 9 months that I'm willing to do this, assuming that I'm doing all the things I'm supposed to do? And you can kind of set that deadline for yourself and then say, if it's beyond that point, then there's signal that there is an appetite in the market for it. And here's the key. What else could I be using this time for? I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to develop a world-changing product that's going to create some sort of amazing unicorn. I'm getting very strong signal from very smart people that this is not the thing for me to develop. And at some point, you have to make the conclusion that I'm wasting my own intellect on this and that I should switch, because maybe I can switch and develop something else. Maybe I can start something new that actually is going to have a higher probability of working. So you could kind of think about it this way. If you knew you were going to keep going a year after that time, trying to raise money for a startup, that you've gotten very strong signals from the market is not worth it. Do you think that that's a better use of that year than taking that year to think about another company you could start and another product that you could start, taking the learnings from the last one into this one? And it seems to me pretty obvious that the second is the better choice.
It's interesting as you kind of relate a few concepts there. One of them is, how do you know what's the best use of your time versus stick or quit? The question I would ask is, and I think this is really the important one, is what kind of mental models can people use to determine whether they should stick or quit? Because I know in my life, I've had many examples that any rational person would just look at and just say, that's silly, you've done this too long. And I've stuck with it and been successful at it. But I've had a feeling, you know, that, hey, this is going to work. I just have to stick with it long enough. And I have other times where I'm like, this isn't going to work and I'm going to cut bait. So how should people think about those?
Look, if we're completely objective, that would just be expected value question. So even in the case where you stuck to something and you thought it would work, what you're saying is that I think the thing I'm doing is positive expected value, meaning for every minute that I put into this, I'm going to get a positive return on that time spent. But that does not mean that it wasn't right for you. It wouldn't be right for you to quit, because it's expected value of the path that you're on in comparison to other paths that you might take. So one of the things that we need to understand is that when we start something, we tend to get really stuck in it. There's a variety of reasons for that. There's a lot of sort of cognitive debris, like cognitive forces that make it very hard for us to walk away from things. One of the most common is the sunk cost fallacy, which makes us think that, well, if I walk away, I'll have wasted all the time that I put into this already. And I imagine that you have had that feeling under those circumstances quite often. We know that what we're trying to do is just get straight to expected value, which is, I can continue doing this, or I can take all that time and I can put it into something else. And do I think that the thing that I'm switched to is going to have a higher expected value than the thing that I'm doing? So expected value in a very simple sense is just like, if you're choosing between stock A and stock B, you should choose the one that has the highest return, taking into consideration your risk tolerance. And that's what you're trying to do in terms of the paths that you take in life. So even the places where you stuck to it and it worked out, it still might have been better for you to quit, because it might have been that you could have gone and taken all that time and energy and go put it into something else that had a higher expected return. But we're very reluctant to quit things for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is sunk cost, and not the least of which is we try to get to certainty that it's not going to work out, or it will, before we're willing to walk away. Now, let me just say that expected value is not an easy way to think about things. It's pretty abstract. There's all sorts of cognitive biases. They're going to distort the way that we think about expected value and cause us to come up with very bad equations. So instead, what I like people to do is use something called kill criteria. So kill criteria is basically this. What are the conditions that I might see at some point in the future? What are the signals that I could see at some point in the future that would tell me that I ought to walk away? Now, we can think about, like, why are we thinking about kill criteria in this way? So why do you set kill criteria? Well, I think that we have the intuition that when we start something, which we're starting under conditions of uncertainty and luck, which means that we're going to discover new information after the fact, by definition, that when that new information is bad news, we will stop doing what we're doing. So if we're climbing a mountain and a blizzard comes upon us, obviously we will turn around. If we're running a marathon and we break our leg, obviously we're going to stop running. If we have a thesis about an investment and then the world tells us that our thesis was bonkers, that obviously we're going to get off the trade. You know, I take a job, I have all sorts of ideas about what the culture is going to be, how much I'm going to enjoy the work, so on and so forth. And then I learn new information that I don't like it very much. So I think that we all think that under those circumstances, we'll walk away and quit. And the answer is no, we won't. Actually, we will escalate our commitment to the cause. We will increase how much we're committed to the cause. I think one place you can see this on the world stage right now very clearly is the war in Ukraine, where Russia was supposed to come in and take Ukraine in 3 days. And obviously, they aren't winning. There's lots of signals that they are not winning that war. But I think we all know that Putin isn't going anywhere, not unless he absolutely has to. And in fact, he is escalating his commitment to the war. He is spending more money. He is sending more missiles. He has conscripted 300,000 more relatively untrained soldiers to send into that war. So there's a good case where we can see that kind of escalation of commitment. And lest you think that's just Putin, we can think about our response to losing the Vietnam War, which was incredibly similar. All right. So as goes war, does go you holding a stock. Because I think we all know it's like you buy a stock at 50, it's trading at 40. It's trading at 40 because everything you thought was going to be true about the world is no longer true. And what do you say when that happens? Well, now it's really cheap. I got to hold it to get my money back. Okay. So given that we know that when we sort of, let's say, come across those signals, when they unfold in real time, we're not going to be particularly good listeners. What we want to do is actually set a list of those signals in advance. And then say, when I see those signals, then I ought to walk away. So you could imagine, for example, like I had an investment. It's 3 months from now and the investment has gone quite poorly. What exactly do I think? Like, why do I think that that occurred? What were the early signals that I imagine I'll see that would tell me that this investment is not going to turn out the way that I had hoped? So you can set those out. So I'll give you a simple example of a kill criteria. So let's say that a year ago, I decided that I was going to invest in Bitcoin. And I had a thesis about why I was investing in Bitcoin, which was that I thought that it would be, my opinion was that it would be uncorrelated with inflation and it would be a hedge against market chaos. I'm buying it not because of the technology or because of the philosophy or anything like that. I'm saying, look, this is going to be a good hedge against chaos and inflation. So I'm not saying whether that was a good thesis or a bad thesis. I don't have a strong opinion on that. And if somebody told me that was their thesis at the time, I would be like, okay, I believe you if that's what you really believe. So now you have that thesis. You would then write down what the kill criteria are, which is when should I get out of this, right? When should I quit? And those kill criteria would be, in this case, very detailed. Like if inflation goes up by this much and I see whatever strength correlation between Bitcoin's price and inflation, in this case, it would be negatively correlated, right? So I see inflation going up and Bitcoin going down where it's correlated to a certain degree, then I have to sell. Likewise, if the stock market goes down and Bitcoin is going down with it, and I see that consistently occurring over some period of time, then I must sell. So you're being very specific about what those fill in the blanks would be. And when you see those, you would have to sell. So that would be an example of a kill criteria. Otherwise, what happens, and I've seen this with people myself, where they invested in, say, Bitcoin for one reason. And then when it goes down, they'll pivot. They'll say, oh, no, well, I'm investing it for the tech, right? Like I believe in what it will do in the future. Or sometimes there's the lovely, now it's really cheap. Like you're laughing, but how many times have you heard people say that?
It's hard not to. It's hard not to say it yourself.
Right. Oh, now that's really cheap. And that's what happens when we sort of leave it to ourselves on the fly. Whereas if we make these commitments in advance with like, look, this is what happens. And by the way, you can have it. Let's say that your thesis assumes that the fundamentals are going to sit within a certain band. Let's say like interest rates are going to sit within a certain band. You can basically set out, well, if interest rates go below that band, what will I do? And if interest rates go above the band, what will I do? So sometimes the answer might be anytime they're outside of the band, I would sell. Sometimes it might be like, look, if I have an inflation hedge on, if it goes above the band, I assume I would be doing pretty well. And I would certainly hold and maybe even increase, right? If it's below the band, maybe I would get off that hedge, depending on why I was thinking, why I was doing what I was doing. So these kinds of things are incredibly important for helping you to be better at these decisions about when you stop the things that you start.
I love that criteria because I think that's important. It's why people do trade journals and set out buy and sell criteria before you even do a trade. Trading's hard enough.
So interestingly enough, so with the people that I've worked with, the journaling is amazing. It tells you what the buy and sell criteria are. Very clearly laid out thesis. And I think that what people do is they make the assumption that having done that work, that because implied in that work is what the conditions would be in the future that might make you increase your position, hold it, or decrease your position, that when that stuff occurs, that will happen. But you actually do need to do an extra step when you're doing a trade journal. You need to not just think about what conditions would I buy or sell, like what's my thesis, so on and so forth, but you do have to say, what does this imply about what the future is going to look like? And if the future does not look like that in these particular ways, then this is what my reaction to this will be. I know it sounds like a distinction without a difference. I've said, this is my thesis. These are the conditions under which I would buy. These are the conditions under which I would sell in terms of when I'm going to put the trade on. So doesn't that mean that I'll be paying attention to those things in terms of taking the trade off? And the answer is no, you won't. Not unless you specifically list them as kill criteria or exit criteria. You need to write those things down. It's really good if you share them with somebody else and say, when I see this, then I'm going to exit. And you can see that with the Bitcoin example. Someone can have a very detailed journal about their reason for buying or shorting or whatever Bitcoin. And they can have like a super detailed journal. But then when it is correlated with inflation, are they selling? No, because they're already in it. But if at the time that you wrote down, like, why am I making this trade, you also had a very specific set of criteria that would tell you when you would exit, you're just much more likely to behave rationally in the face of that decision.
Trading's hard to begin with. You know, one of the things I was thinking about before the interview was, you know, I'm from Boston, so Tom Brady's kind of a staple up here. And you think about decisions like athletes that are, their identities tied up with toughness. And here you have somebody who's trying to continue his career much longer than maybe his family would have liked, or you can't read his mind. But I would imagine with people like athletes, where being tough is a part of who you are, it's really tough to know when to leave at the top. So what should people like that do to think about quitting?
First of all, I just want to say, like, some of this is what your own values are. So Tom Brady may be okay with having a terrible last season. I don't know if he does or not. What I do know is that the human tendency is to want to have that terrible season before you leave, because the feeling of what if, but what if I had played one more time? Maybe I would have gotten the seventh Super Bowl.
Quite a few.
Six or seven. You know, that feeling is so hard for us. In the same sense of, like, if you sell a stock and then it goes up afterwards, how painful is that? So in that particular case, it's like particularly painful because we can see it happen. But even in the hypothetical and the counterfactual, we're like, but maybe if I played that last season, I could have gotten another ring. Maybe that would have been the year that I got another ring. I think that those things are really hard. So we want to sort of butt up against the certainty that we have no other choice. That's kind of for ourselves. Richard Thaler said to me, like, nobody wants to quit until it's no longer a decision. So like when he has such a bad season that the team doesn't even want him on it anymore, well, then, okay, it's pretty easy to walk away at that point because you're not wondering like, well, what if I had stayed? But the other thing that you're getting out of that is other people aren't wondering what if you had stayed. So we can go to like a Barry Sanders type of situation. How mad are people at Barry Sanders? Like still today, they're like, what? Why? Because for him, I don't think that he wanted CTE. I know that that was part of his decision-making. You know, he felt like his body was taking a battering, so on and so forth. And so he decided, like, look, I'm great. I'm just going to quit now when I'm great before I start like the horrible decline. And maybe I can't ever walk again because I have two knee replacements that don't work very well. But people are super mad because he did it again. It's an expected value equation, and value is in there, not just in terms of like money, but also what are your own values? Like, what am I going to get out of it? And what he determined was at that moment in time, as he looked at what was going to happen over the future, that the costs outweighed the benefits. And so he quit. That's fine. Now, Tom Brady may be okay with playing until he sort of falls into being somewhat mediocre. That may be okay with him. I don't know. But I know that the tendency is to do that thing rather than the Barry Sanders thing. And that more of us would be better off if we kind of did the Barry Sanders thing. So how do you actually get to that? Well, the way that I kind of think about it is this use of kill criteria is very helpful for this, because there's some point at which, well, Tom Brady decided to retire. Then the question is, how do you think about whether you should come back or not? Or you're in a job and you have that thought like, oh, I'm not happy. Maybe I should quit. Or you're an employer. You're like, oh, I'm not happy with this employee. Maybe I should let them go. Or you're in a relationship. You're like, oh, I've really got this nagging feeling. I'm unhappy. Maybe I should leave. So we all have those moments, right? And the thing that we know is that in those moments, we're not going to make particularly good decisions about whether we should stay or whether we should go. So what you can do is in that moment, you could say, how long am I okay with the status quo? Let's say that you're thinking about retiring from football and you say, I feel like maybe I need a little bit more information before I leave. I've got to think about how long am I okay with the situation as I am in now. And maybe you say, I want to give it one more season. Okay, that's fine. Then you say, what could I be seeing? And can be very specific, like in terms of my stats, you know, my productivity on the field, in terms of my body. What are the things, and you could talk to a medical doctor. What are the things that you could be seeing, doctor, that would tell you that maybe I shouldn't be playing another season after this? And you can write those things down. You can think about things that are subjective, like what's my level of happiness? What's my expectation for how I should benchmark that? So you can figure out whatever the set of things are that would tell you either that this is worth continuing or it's not worth continuing anymore. And you can commit to that. Because otherwise, what can happen is you're like, oh, I'm going to give it one more season. And then it's the end of the season. And it's like, tomorrow's always tomorrow, right? And you're like, oh, but then I'll give it another season. I'll give it another season, even though you really hit those kill criteria. So you can do that with an employee as well. How long am I okay with having somebody who's performing up to this level in this seat? What are the things that I would expect to see in terms of showing me that it's been turned around? What are the things that I would expect to see that would tell me that this isn't worthwhile anymore? So let's say you say, I can deal with this situation for 6 more weeks before I initiate a search. And you figure out, like, what are the signals that would tell me that this employee is still not performing? What are the signals that would tell me that they've turned it around? What are the things that I need to do to help them and support them to see if they can get there? Then you're just much more likely to get to those decisions more quickly, which is way better for everybody.
No, I couldn't agree more. You just mentioned a lot of different hot topics, relationships, employees. They're
all
hard.
Well, you know, that's the thing about decision making, Kirk. It's everything.
Harder when the emotions get involved.
Well, and this is what I'm trying to do, is get the emotion out of it, right? Because obviously in that moment when you're like, I want to quit, that's an emotional moment for you. You're going to be good at making that decision in that moment? I don't think so. So if you just step back and say, like, how long am I okay with the status quo? You know, maybe with a job that you have, it's another quarter. I hope that you're hearing this concept of a deadline. So you always want to have a deadline that's going along with these. I call it states and dates. What's the date and what's the state of the world? So sometimes the deadline is like, I can't quit until I have 6 months of runway. So I'm going to work to build up 6 months of runway. And that's my date. That's the stop time. And then at that time, what are the things that would tell me that I should stick it out? What are the things that would tell me that I ought to quit?
Great. Well, Annie, I really appreciate you joining us on the show. My brain is full, so thank you.
Well, I'm glad I filled your brain.
Yes, thank you. There's so many mental models here that you can use for investing, for life, for pretty much really anything that applies to your life. So appreciate you sharing. Annie, where can people find more about you and some of your works?
The best place to find me is annieduke.com, which is my website. You can find video, you can contact me there, get old versions of my newsletter, so on and so forth. I'm on Twitter for the moment, at Annie Duke. But you can also find me on the normal other social channels. And I hope that people will check out the Alliance for Decision Education, which is the nonprofit that I co-founded to bring decision education to every K-12 classroom.
This is a public service announcement. Hi, my name's Kirk. I'm with the government and I'm here to help. Doesn't that sound reassuring? Well, let's talk about how they're helping. The government needs your help to make our money worthless again. PPP loans, student loan forgiveness, helicopter money. Let's keep the party going until our money is totally worthless. Don't think it can happen? Sure it can. Just ask Zimbabwe, Venezuela, Greece, Germany, Hungary, Greece, Yugoslavia. Did I mention Greece? As a loyal listener to the show, I want to reward you with a gift. I want to give you free money. I'm giving away money from one of these six hyperinflationary currencies. Go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money and follow the instructions to get your free gift. I have a large audience and only a limited number of these currencies, so make sure you get yours before they run out. Go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money and get your free gift today. I want to get into the panel portion of the show here, where we have our very own Barb Freeburg. Hey, Barb.
Hi, so happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. Also, we have our very own Megan Gorman. Hey, Megan.
Hey, Kirk. How you doing today?
Doing great. Well, let's just dive right in. So, Megan, what were some of your thoughts here from the interview?
Listening to the interview made me want to buy her book, and I actually did. I thought she was fascinating, and she was really, really good at laying out some of the hardest challenges we deal with in working with clients. And specifically, I would say, in terms of things like factoring in luck versus skill, I think that particularly in very good markets, people overestimate skill and underestimate luck. And I thought she laid that out really, really well with decision making. So for me, it was a lot of confirmation of what I experience in working with clients. And I really just thought she added a thoughtful approach. And the other thing that I just as a takeaway, and this we probably won't talk about, but what I also found fascinating about her is she's had like five careers. And I liked that about her because I think that that is much more normal today. So that was my takeaways.
Yeah, I think the luck versus skill, that's one of my favorite concepts I like to teach, you know, is the difference between luck versus skill and the fact that we always blame ourselves for the skill and we blame luck for the bad luck, but the good luck is skill. So that's one of my favorites. It happens all the time with clients over the years. So Barb, what about you? What were some of your takeaways?
I liked so much that she laid out the way to make decisions in a statistical strategy. So she made things that are kind of back of the napkin decisions. She gave a framework for which we can make decisions. So expected value means what are the likely outcomes that something is going to happen? So you can actually quantify it. Not perfectly, of course, but you can look at it more scientifically than you normally would. And then I also love the kill concept. When I used to be a stock picker, I would automatically write down, after I had analyzed a stock pick and bought it, I would write down the reasons to sell. And I'd go back and review it. And I trained myself to sell the losers when they looked like they were meeting criteria. And I think that's a really good strategy for anyone who is buying stocks or mutual funds.
Let's dig into that a little bit, Barb. I think this is one of those areas that you could go crazy thinking about it, but you put down reasons to sell. So how do you think about it when you're, you know, buying a position? What does that look like for you?
I was a fundamental investor, and I still am, and I still use those fundamental strategies. And what that means is you use ratios, sales measures, earnings measures, price earnings ratio, cash flow, all different sorts of ratios. You compare them, decide if they equate to creating an investment that is a fairly valued investment, an undervalued, or an overvalued. And then you also look at the analyst reports. You look at the annual reports to see what are the growth prospects. So if the company's doing well, what do they have projected in the future that's going to enable them to continue to grow? So that's the type of information that I use to buy. Typically, I won't buy a stock that is way overvalued. It might be a great company, but if the price is too high, I have a lower likelihood of getting my money back or getting a good return. So that's what I do on the buy end. But my theses don't always work out. as is the case with any sort of investor. Sometimes you're wrong. And so after I've made that buy, after I've laid out the reasons I have bought the stock, and I write those down. And I do that with mutual funds as well, because I'm constantly analyzing whether I've got the best ETFs in my portfolio or not. So I have reasons to sell. Let's say they don't meet their growth metrics. Let's say the competitive environment gets too tough. Or let's say that there's something that I anticipate that could happen, that could go wrong, that could cause the company to do poorly. That might be a reason to sell. And typically when a stock drops in value, I do not wait for it to come back to even. That is like one of the most typical biases for investors. If they have a loss, they think, well, I'll sell it, but only if it goes back to even. What I do is I look at that stock and I say, would I buy this today based on the information I have? And if the answer is no, then I will sell it and take the loss.
That's a good philosophy, I think, having that kill criteria. Are you mainly focused on the fundamentals for the kill criteria? Are you also looking at other things like price and, I guess, comparable opportunities?
Yes, I look at all of those things because fundamentals are only one part of the picture. You have to look at the drivers of the growth. I mean, that's the biggest thing. And then you have to look at the market environment. What's going on? I mean, look at AOL. You know, we all thought AOL was amazing. Look at the Betamax, if you want to date yourself. That was incredible technology. So you have to look at so many different factors and you have to try and be scientific. Look, we can't be scientific. We never have all the information. So you do the best you can with the information you have, and then you don't be afraid to sell. Don't be afraid to take a loss. You're going to take losses sometimes. And typically, if you use sound principles that you have laid out in advance, your investment winners will trump your losers.
Yeah, that's great advice. So Megan, getting back to you, when you're working with clients, how do you handle the kill criteria that we're talking about with clients?
I think in all of this, you want to control the controllables. There are so many factors to investing that are beyond your control. Things like I talked about in terms of luck. And it's sort of funny in watching clients over the years, I have some clients who have amazing timing, and then I have other clients that consistently have bad timing. So what you're trying to really do, and Barb, I think, laid this out quite well, is create a repeatable and disciplined process. And even like when I work with clients, our meetings have a repeatable and disciplined agenda. It's very clear how I walk clients through things. And that's how we want them to be looking at their portfolios. Because their portfolios, it's too easy to make a short-term decision on something just because of a short-term blip in performance. So a lot of the work we have to do is focusing on what is our long-term goals? What are we trying to achieve? Why is investing, real investing, as dull as watching paint dry? You know, and really focusing on, okay, here is the due diligence process that allowed us to go into this holding. And this is the due diligence process that would allow us to judge if this is a holding to keep or get rid of, just like Barb walked us through. And I will tell you that the people who do the best with this are the ones who don't get very emotional. And I think that that's really interesting about poker players, is that they're very good at checking their emotions at the door. The group of clients that I have that are constantly looking, particularly in this marketplace, they're panicking and just making bad decisions, and you're trying to hold them in place. And I'll give you a quick example. I had someone who had an opportunity to exercise some stock options and is now sitting in cash and has been worried about going into the market. And one of the things that we have spent time talking about is that today, and this might sound crazy, but today there's lower risk in the market than there has been a year ago. And going through data points that would make you start to see that this entry into the market is not a bad time to start doing it. But this person I've worked with for years, has consistently always let their emotions overtake them. And even in going through a disciplined process and looking at data, they become too overwhelmed to make a decision, which is why I have had to express to them, I'm concerned about meeting their goals. So I really, really encourage people to have a discipline system, control the controllables, but the things you can't control, like the market, don't look. Just let it go. And that makes a big, big difference. And I'll just say one thing about process. And that is, when you study some of the best leaders, some of the best American presidents and their leadership skills, a lot of them are poker players. Eisenhower, one of the best poker players out there, and consistently played, not just when he was in the military, but when he was leading World War II and as a president. And I think it's very telling that his decisions were very firm, he was very clear, and he stuck to strategy. And you could make an argument he had one of the most successful presidencies. So looking at the people who are able to cut emotion off and stick to process is really, really key.
You mentioned one thing, which is we have lower risk today than last year. Can you expand on that? Because I think it's a great concept.
What has happened over the past year is all the key fundamentals about interest rates, inflations have flipped on their head and the market has reacted. And by the way, if the market hadn't reacted the way it had, I would be concerned. The market should be down with all the key fundamentals changing. But today, when you look at the market, what is interesting is, one, equities are far more reasonably valued than they were a year ago. Fixed income is paying income, cash is paying yield. And so today, if you go into the market, could the market still go down? Yes, completely. But it likely won't go down as much as it would have gone down if you went in a year ago, meaning things are more reasonably priced. The market has digested the Fed rate increases. The market is digesting how we're managing inflation. And so therefore, your risk is lower of a great drop. Doesn't mean it won't happen. But again, you might not see a 30% drop. You'd see a 10% drop. So it's about patience in this. And so that's why I think today entering the market, it's not a bad point in time. You'll probably get some things that are more of a deal. And if you're really, really nervous, what I've always found is that the repeatable and disciplined process here is dollar cost averaging. It's boring, it's hokey, but it actually works and it helps you manage your emotion as you try to enter the market. And I don't know, Barb, it looks like you wanted to say something as I was speaking. So I'd love to hear your point of view.
What are my thoughts? Like, that gigantic, you're like my husband who like reads my mind and says, what are you nervous about? I know you're thinking about something now. Megan, you're amazing. You know me too well. So yes, first of all, I wanted to talk about valuations, which is, what does it mean that the market is cheaper? We use ratios to help us determine if the price of a market, just one simple value that I talk about all the time, which is the price earnings ratio. That is the amount of money you will pay for $1 of earnings of a company. So if the price earnings ratio is 25, you're going to pay $25 for $1 of earnings of the company. If the price earnings ratio is 15, you're going to pay $15 for $1 of earnings. I'd rather pay 15 than I would 25 for the same company for the same dollar of earnings. So that's what Megan is talking about. That's one of the metrics, not the only metric. But it's really important, and a lot of analysts use that as a way to determine if you're getting a bargain or you're getting a fair price or if you're overpaying. So that was one thing going through my mind. The other is interest rates. Now, many of us listening may be over 50. I don't know. I'm not sure. Kirk can probably tell me. But if you're getting up there in the second half of your life, you may want to be a little more conservative with your investment portfolio, which means you may not want to have as great a stock allocation. Now, the past 10 years, I mean, it was devastating for any of us that had bonds or cash. You couldn't even get 1% yield on a money market account. You get like 0.01%. Now, oh my gosh, I just got a message from my high yield cash account at my bank. They're paying 4%. So now is a time that you want to say, okay, the average return on stocks over the long term is 8 to 9, 10%. With that return, you have a lot of risk, which means you may have drawdowns of 10, 20, 30% in a year. The average return on bonds over long periods of time is about 5%, but you typically don't have those drawdowns. So if you're at the point where you're getting a little sick and tired of that volatility, you also want to preserve some of your cash and not so much grow it all, then you want to seriously be looking at bond-type investments, treasury bonds, corporate bonds that are paying higher yields. You can lock in higher yields, and you will smooth out the volatility of your portfolio and lock in a basic cushion of returns. So that's what was going through my mind.
And the other thing I'll say about it too, with cash being where it's at right now, everybody's got pretty cheap money on their mortgages. What I like about where cash is today, which to your point, I'm seeing it yields between 3.5% to 4.5%, depending on the type of money market or cash management strategy. It's really great leveraging. Why pay down mortgage debt? There's no reason to. You can earn your interest for the debt on cash. And that's such a low risk investment. So to some degree, for everybody out there listening, the market we're in right now is pretty exciting. There's a lot of opportunities out there. And a lot of the challenges have started to work through the system. And never forget, when you look at 8 of the past 9 recessions since 1960, the market halfway through the recession or so has started to see through the recession and start to return, even when data like unemployment continues to raise. The one aberration, just so everybody knows, is the 2001 recession. And that is because at the tail end of it, there was a terror attack, which basically threw everything into another challenge. So I'm excited about this market. And the more I talk to clients, the more we start going through data. I think it's really important to show people data to help with that repeatable discipline process. People are getting excited about what's coming up ahead.
I couldn't agree more. I think there's definitely more opportunity this year than last year. It's interesting. You can actually look at assets again, like fixed income, and say, hey, wow, there's fixed income that actually makes sense right now, as opposed to last year, which, as Barb said, I think it was 0.1%. I think that was if you're lucky. I think some place actually charge you money to put money with them. But I did want to get into cognitive biases. I mean, we all live with these every single day of our lives. And when it comes to investing, these are extremely important. If you don't understand how they apply and how you can combat them, it actually can severely negatively impact your performance and your portfolio. So Barb, let's start with you. What are some cognitive biases or some of the favorite ones, or maybe even some of your white whales, if you will, when it comes to cognitive biases?
Well, the first one I talked about before was anchoring, which is I'm not going to sell because I'm going to wait for my price to get back. I've talked about that. The other one that is huge that I have seen in play for the last few years is called the herding bias, which means if other people are doing it, I should do it too, which is a recipe for disaster. Because if you're following the crowd, you are getting swept up into a frenzy and you will typically end up buying high. So be aware of, as many investors, including Warren Buffett, have said, don't be greedy. When others are greedy, you want to be cautious. And when other people are cautious, you want to be greedy. So as a note to Megan's client today, now is absolutely the time to get back in the market. You may not hit the bottom, but you are certainly going to be better off than if you wait for the rebound. So those are two biases. I'm going to give you another one, which is called the overconfidence bias. And that wraps up in the discussion we had at the beginning of the podcast, which is, are good investors lucky or smart? And sometimes you don't know the difference. Overconfidence bias is when the S&P 500 is reaching 25% in a year and you think you are the greatest investor ever. First of all, it doesn't take any skill to invest in the S&P 500, which, by the way, I think is a very good barometer of how to get good returns. It's a good investment. The market has done very well. But don't confuse the fact of matching returns with an advancing market with being a good investor. And on the flip side, and Annie mentioned this too, sometimes you'll have a losing investment, and that doesn't mean you're a bad investor. So overconfidence means that you know more than you do. So I think those three are enough to get you started.
What's interesting today is it's never been easier to invest in the market. I always tell my team when I was a kid, you had to like look things up in the newspaper. Like it was a much more complicated system. But part of the challenges with being so easy to access the investment market is it's way too easy to access information. And information bias is one of the biggest challenges I find, because what happens, we're all going to get information, whether we're watching TikTok videos, CNBC, Wall Street Journal, but it's really how you prioritize your evaluation of them. And that's one of the things that really you have to work on, which is which noise are you going to tune out and which noise are you going to focus on? So one of the things I would tell anyone who's working with advisors, part of the benefit of working with an advisor is they should be taking you through economic data coming from the top tier economists and explaining to you to give context. Because at the end of the day, investing is a science. And that data really can sort of clear the air and give you real perspective. Where if you're listening to some TikTok video or somebody on CNBC, you have to remember the reason they're putting that information out there is to get you to watch, to tune in, to sensationalize. And so maybe that data, while there are nuggets of truth in it, shouldn't be overemphasized versus economic data that has reasoning and data behind it and the science of investing. So really, really think about where you're going to get your information and be wary of information bias.
Hey, Megan, I've got to jump in here because that is one of my pet peeves. There's so many people out there. They're dynamic. They're interesting. They're certainly more glamorous than I am, but maybe they got rid of $100,000 of debt. And so they think they're an expert in investing. What you can do now to make sure you're listening to people who are smart is learn how to distinguish between someone who has credentials, experience, and knowledge in investing. Go to their LinkedIn profile. What is their college degree, their master's degree, and what are their certifications? Are they skilled in investing? Almost any information that you'll get off of your Fidelity, your Schwab, your Vanguard websites is really good information. You can trust that information. If you look at the Federal Reserve site, you're going to get good information. If you look at the CFA site, which is the Certified Chartered Financial Analyst website, you're going to get good information. So make sure before you dive in and follow somebody who got rid of a bunch of debt and is really cute on TikTok, make sure they know what they're talking about.
Totally agree. Well, as we kind of get ready to wrap it up here, final thoughts from you, Megan.
I think her book, I can't wait to read it. I think that the point she lays out is really important. But I think just to emphasize, most people don't realize, you know, when they look at the spectrum from skill to, you know, just random luck, investing is sort of in the middle there. It takes skill, but you have to have moments where things do work in your favor. You know, you've invested in a fund and it's a small cap fund and small cap has a great year and a great run. And so as a way to make sure that you're running your portfolio the right way, focus on a disciplined approach on how you run it, how you make choices in it, when you decide to buy, when you decide to sell, and be wary of information bias. Have your key places that you turn to for economic data and stick with that. And remember, it's incredibly boring to be a good investor. It is not exciting. It is not meme stocks. It is just boring. So I'm Megan Gorman. You can find me at Forbes.com. Kirk, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on, Megan. And Barb, final thoughts from you.
Diversification. Nobody knows the future. Small cap value, huge outperformer this year. Yeah, I've had that in my portfolio for decades. has done really not much, but give me a couple points in dividends. This year, it's gone through the roof. So don't try and pick the right sector. Don't try and pick the right asset. Have a smartly diversified portfolio that you have created with a sane and smart strategy. And then just stick with that. If you want to play around, choose a small percentage of your investable assets, 5%, maybe go up to 10%. But most of us do not have the time or the discipline or the knowledge to be active traders. And if you do, well, more power to you. But in general, the data is pretty clear that just sticking with a diversified U.S. and global stocks, bonds, a little bit of cash, and just keeping your asset allocation in line with your risk tolerance and your financial goals, that will take you a long way towards successful investing. I'm Barb Friedberg. You can find me on YouTube at RoboAdvisor Pros and at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance.
Thanks for coming on, Barb. And that's the show for this week. Thank you again for joining us, Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app if you're choosing. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to our show notes, resources, and archive shows. Also, we're now on YouTube, so please check out our YouTube channel. When you're there, please subscribe and leave a comment. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment in the podcast app of your choice. Oh, and don't forget, do your own research. This show is for informational use only. We're not telling you what to think, merely how to think about investing. We're not selling any products or services and do not consider this advice. Also, if you have any problems with the show, I blame Putin. Please call him directly and express your feelings. If you're seeking financial advice, talk to an oracle, a fortune teller, or maybe a licensed financial advisor. I'm one, but as I said, I'm not selling anything. But I'm easy to find. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.